from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the amazing story of Coral Castle. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. The Rasmussen Report's daily presidential tracking poll shows that 55% of the likely U.S. voters now approve of President Trump's job performance, 45% disapprove, and the president held an hour-and-a-half news conference today. It was different. I've seen a lot of presidential news conferences in my career. This one was different. Let me bring in Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. I think you would say the same thing, John, huh? It's different.
Well, no, it's different in that he's continuing the narrative, denouncing the mainstream media as creating fake news. It worked during the campaign. The media had Trump losing the election. Every major publication, every broadcast network, with the exception of Fox, had Trump losing the election, and they all lost. And I've said this before, that the 2016 election was a referendum on the U.S. media, the mainstream media. And there have been Pew reports recently that showed that the trust in the American media as being objective, neutral, and upholding the First Amendment is at an all-time low. And I think that, he gave Jim Acosta a question, and Acosta really, he allowed him to ask whether he thought that, his criticism of the press was indictment on the First Amendment. That's what Acosta was asking. Essentially, what Trump said is that the attack on the First Amendment is about a mainstream media that is generating fake news and has such vitriol for him and his administration that nobody can trust it anymore. So that's what you saw. But I have to tell you, if you listen to the liberal press analyze what happened in this press conference, they'll say something like, well, Trump was out of line, inappropriate, unhinged. That's how they describe it. What I observed is somebody that has the control of a press room like Ronald Reagan had. This is the first president that I've seen since Reagan that has shown so much composure. There was such a kind of gleeful quality as there was with Reagan when he confronted the press and was always good for a one-liner. I remember when he was asked, on the Iran-Contra question. I don't know if you remember this, George.
Oh, I do.
When he was asked, well, how could this go on in the White House? Do you really take the presidency? I think it was Helen, from UPI that asked it. Helen Thomas. And do you really take the presidency that lightly? And he looked at her and he says, the only thing that I've taken lightly since I've been here is doing these press conferences. The whole room broke into laughter. That's the same command that Trump showed today when he told Acosta that he has a new way of describing what's going on in the mainstream media. And it's not fake news anymore. It's very fake news.
Well, and what the president, though, needs to be careful about, John, because he was talking about how he had the second highest electoral vote since Reagan. That's not true.
No, that's not true. And remember that Reagan had...
And then he said, but when asked by a reporter, how can you say that? You're accusing us of fake news, and you've just spouted these facts. His answer was, well, that's what they told me.
Well,
that's kind of scary for a president to be given numbers like that, and he just spouts them off, and he's wrong.
No, he is wrong about the numbers. But again, there's a difference between recounting a number that is incorrect and generating a story like those fake tweets that came out that were cited by Nancy Pelosi and Elijah Cummings, basically, this was about the National Security Advisor Flynn tweeting this out on his own site that he had contact with the Russians. There was some nefarious contact with the Russians. Well, it turns out it wasn't Flynn's website at all. It was completely fake, and they were not just duped. They actually took duped information and recalling from congressional information on the basis of a fake report off of Twitter.
Okay, one last question, because you did support Donald Trump during his campaign. Now as president, if you were working for him and with him, what would you advise him based on everything you saw today? What would you say?
Well, I would say exactly what you said, George, which is to, you know, try to recount the factual things, especially, you know, the numbers a little bit more carefully. But I would say just keep on going, doing exactly what you're doing, because I think he's winning the battle with the press.
All right. John Curtis, his website, onlinecolumnist.com. A suicide attack in a popular shrine in southern Pakistan killed 72 people. The bomber blew himself up among the people. Jeez. Malaysia police say that they have a third person now who's been arrested in connection with the apparent poisoning death of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. A police official said the officers detained a Malaysian man. He is believed to be the boyfriend of the second suspect. More worries and concerns about Yahoo. Yahoo's security woes continue, with the company sending out fresh warnings to users over hacked accounts at the hands of alleged state-sponsored actors. In an email to users, Yahoo said it has identified evidence of cookie forging attacks on some accounts, which would allow attackers to access an account without re-entering a password. The email was only sent to accounts that Yahoo believes have been affected by these intrusion attempts, so we don't know how many people have been impacted. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. What's this all mean, Lauren?
You know, I was thinking that it would have been appropriate to start this segment playing I Got You, Babe, right? from Groundhog Day. We keep waking up at 6 a.m. and it's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Again.
It never stops.
It's just unbelievable. We can't really tell from what Yahoo said today, except it's more of the same. We know there were a billion users affected over the last several years with birth dates and security questions potentially compromised. And that's bad stuff, of course, because if you give honest birth dates and you answer some of these security questions honestly, which I generally don't recommend, I suggest you use fake answers on security questions as long as you know what you keep track of what you're saying and you know what you're putting down, and use different ones at different sites, because generally security questions are just a security nightmare. How many more are affected now? We don't know. The amazing thing about this is that Verizon is still going ahead and buying Yahoo. Apparently,
they're still doing it. I know.
Yeah,
did they reduce the value at all?
Yeah, they're going to get a. I hear they're going to get a $250 million discount, supposedly, from $4.8 billion. I personally wouldn't pay more than $250 for Yahoo. But then I don't travel in those circles. I do have one recommendation for listeners, though, and I mean, we've really reached this point. If you still are using Yahoo for email, get off of there. Get a Gmail account, get a Microsoft account, do something, but get your email off of Yahoo. It's not going to get any better there, and it's important to protect yourself, and the writing's on the wall.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. Listen to this one. An Earth-sized virtual telescope is ready to take the very first picture ever of a black hole, the monster mysterious object at the center of our galaxy. That's going to be incredible. Wires and tubes and lots of glass and plastic, that's what television recyclers usually find inside old sets. But for one worker in Canada, the discovery of a secret box helped jar the memory of a forgotten inheritance. More than $100,000 in cash was found inside a television that was being processed at an Ontario recycling plant last month. The money was found inside a cash box stashed into the TV console. In those days, televisions were in consoles like that. Along with the money, there were documents that led police to the unidentified 68-year-old owner of the television, who told investigators that he gave the set to a friend 30 years ago and that he apparently had forgotten that the money was inside. How can you forget that? $100,000 and you forget you put it inside of a television? I don't get it. Up next, it's called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. McKay Jenkins joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. McKay Jenkins holds degrees from Amherst College, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism in Princeton, where he received a PhD in English. After experiencing a very severe health scare on his own, he set out to discover the truth about toxic chemicals, our alarming levels of exposure, and our government's failure to regulate them effectively. Now, he discovered that he spent his life marinating in toxic stuff. And from his wall-to-wall carpeting to his dryer sheets to his drinking water, here he is on Coast to Coast. His latest work is called Food Fight. McKay, I remember food fights in school, but not like this.
No, this is a food fight at a very large scale. It's funny that you mentioned the book about the toxic chemicals was called Contamination, which was about the toxic petrochemicals that get into all our consumer products, from our drinking water bottles to our cosmetics, to everything that we use to clean our bodies and our hair and our children and everything else. There are alarming levels of chemicals in all those. But that book really didn't address food. And so I set out to really look into our industrial food system to see what kinds of things we're eating, how we got to where we are, and came up with some fairly troubling evidence about things. Not just about the chemicals, like the pesticides and herbicides mm-hmm. that we get, but also genetically modified food, which is really what the book is about.
We have championed campaigns to try to stop GMOs, try to at least get the foods labeled, and we have backed people who are pushing those campaigns on this program, okay, with some success in some cases, but not enough is being done.
Well, you know, I've been listening to the segments that you've done so far, and I see a common thread here when you're talking about fake news and how people have this really deep distrust of all kinds of things. They have deep distrust of the press. They have deep distrust of the president, depending on which side you're on.
That's right.
There's really this feeling that nobody knows who to trust anymore, and I think this labeling question really speaks to that. People, when it comes to what they eat, which is one of the most intimate things you'll do every day, people don't know what's in their food. They don't know who to ask for real advice about what's in their food. The whole process of eating has become a really mysterious thing to people. And this is really what this book is about, is trying to lay out exactly how the system that feeds us all has been built and how it all functions. And labeling is a big part of that, for sure.
Has the system been bought off to the point where they don't want to take care of us or defend us?
Well, I think the question is, who is they? So there are two large groups that people get most frustrated at. One is government, which they think is not protecting them, and I think that's a legitimate gripe. The second is the industry, which is providing the food that is trying to avoid being regulated. So what you have is giant industrial, chemical, agricultural companies that control everything that we eat, and there are only really about six companies that are in control of a very large percentage of what we're eating every day. And they have so much money and so much power that they, of course, dictate policy in Washington. So the policy that's not protecting us is being dictated by the companies. So the companies dictate it. The regulators don't do their job, and we are all left holding the bag. So really, they're two groups that are kind of working in collusion, and we then don't get the food or the information that we really need.
The title, Food Fight, tell me about that, because I think that's so appropriate for what we're talking about tonight.
Well, people have very strong opinions about these things. If you ask someone what they think about GMOs, they will probably give you a very strong opinion, but they may not have a depth to their argument that I think they could use. So whether you're pro or con, this book will really offer you a lot more evidence to support your thoughts about things, because GMOs are now, I mean, all it is really a plant. It's a technology for breeding plants. That's really all we're talking about. The question is, how are those GMOs used? In this country, they're used largely to grow herbicide-resistant and pesticide-resistant corn and soybeans, two crops that are now spread on close to 170 million acres of American land. 170 million acres of land to create two different grains that go into feeding the animals that we eat in fast food restaurants, processed food, empty calories, really. I mean, this food that they're producing is really not nutritious. It's not terribly healthy. So regardless of what you think of the technology, the food it creates is really not beneficial, and that's a much larger conversation than whether you like the technology or not.
Is it also a way to control the seeds so you make a lot of money exclusively with them?
Absolutely, sure. I mean, these companies create the seeds, they patent the seeds, they control the seeds, and then if any farmer happens to have any of these seeds drift onto their own crops, they can get hassled by the companies. They can get
sued.
They can get sued in court. I mean, there's all kinds of that sort of thing. That's all to protect the very large amount of money that these companies are putting into growing these seeds. But it creates, as you say many times in the show, it really creates this culture of paranoia and suspicion and worry about who's got the consumers back. And right now, it doesn't seem like the companies or the government are terribly interested in providing good, nutritious food for people. They're interested in creating enormous profits on unhealthy food.
And McKay, what about the dangers and the science behind playing around with Mother Nature? I mean, they are literally altering the genetics of these foods, from corn to soybeans to, you know, just about everything. Isn't that a danger one day?
Well, this is certainly something that a lot of people are worried about. I will tell you what the global scientific community says, and then you can accept that or not. The global scientific community, I mean the most highly respected scientific organizations in the world, not just in the U.S., but in the world, they all say the same thing, that eating GMOs is no more dangerous to your health than eating regular food. That's what they say, and there's almost unanimity in that. Many, many people don't buy that. I mean, just at their gut level, they say eating something that has been manipulated in a laboratory cannot possibly be the same as something that has evolved over millions of years to grow out in a field. Now, that's really more of a philosophical question than a scientific one, I suppose you could say, and that's where a lot of scientists get really angry, because they say that doesn't make any scientific sense. On the other hand, it's hard to argue with somebody's gut when they say, you know, people have been eating a certain kind of way for a very long time, and now there's this new thing. How do you expect me to trust it? I think that gets back to this whole question of who people think they can trust.
Well, and I'm not sure I would want to eat knowingly some kind of food that has been altered to fight insects or weeds built into the food. Because what will it do to you once it hits your stomach?
Well, I think here's where we can start breaking things down. So the GMO corn that you're talking about has been altered to have a bacterium inside it that will let the corn resist being eaten by caterpillars. So you are in essence eating an insecticide. The argument is that insecticide is a naturally occurring bacterium that has been introduced into the corn plant. On the other hand, there are the herbicide-resistant GMOs are being designed so that when you spray them with chemicals, they will not wither and die. It'll kill everything else, but it won't kill that plant. And so, therefore, you are, by definition, going to be absorbing a lot of petrochemical herbicides. So that's the major thing here that we're talking about. If you have, you know, 100 million acres of soybeans that are being sprayed with herbicides, now you're getting the herbicides in the soybeans. There's just no getting around that. Now, you may not care about that, but that's pretty much a given with the way these things are grown.
And where do we stand right now with the science in terms of what they're going to do in the future? I mean, how many more foods will they alter?
Well, you just saw about 2 weeks ago, I mean, so just back up. So everybody around the world is more worried about this than Americans are. And part of it is because we're drinking the Kool-Aid of these companies and just being told that there's no problem. Everyone else in the world is way more suspicious than we are. So you take that as a given. Now, the companies are desperately trying to find a product that will make Americans feel better about GMOs. And about 2 weeks ago, they introduced something known as the Arctic apple, which is a GMO apple. And the only thing it does is that when you cut it open, it doesn't turn brown right away. And I don't know about you, but that just does not seem to be all that sexy to me. What I think is going on is the companies want something that will turn Americans around and make them happier about GMOs, so then they can start introducing all kinds of other things. And the future is going to be dizzying, because you're going to suddenly not just have GMO plants, but now you have this technology called CRISPR, which is going to allow scientists to alter the genetics of animals. So you're going to start to see everything from pigs to chickens to cattle that are going to have their genetics altered. You've got a GMO salmon. You know, you're suddenly going to have way larger and more visible animal products out there on the market, and that's going to be a real game changer, I think.
It's remarkable what's happening, and it's happening worldwide, right?
Well,
It's happening. What's really happening is these inventions are happening here, and then they're being spread around the world. It's not like there are farmers in Africa genetically altering plants.
Right.
They are just trying to figure out how to grow food in a world that is getting warmer and drier and all that. And it's interesting because American scientists, American companies are trying to push products on some of these farmers around the world, and the countries in the developing world are not always so thrilled about getting them.
Hold on, McKay. We're going to come back in just a moment as we talk more about food fight, GMOs, and the future of the American diet. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're going to take your calls next hour with McKay Jenkins as we talk about his latest work, Food Fight. McKay, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with people's digestive systems these days. We have doctors that come on and say, you need a gluten-free diet, folks. Stay away from that. But you think there could be something else going on here?
Well, it's interesting, again, to think about where does gluten come from? Gluten comes from wheat. Now, wheat is not GMO. This is something that may surprise people. As I mentioned before, GMOs really are almost exclusively found in the American diet in soybeans and corn. The thing is, those soybeans and corn can be turned into tens of thousands of different kinds of products. For example, you'll have, you know, GMO corn will be in your soda because it is, you know, the high fructose corn syrup that is sweetening your soda. You will have GMO soybeans in your processed foods. Both the soybeans and the corn are being used to feed the animals that are feeding you all the meat that you eat, especially the lower cost meat that you find at fast food restaurants. Wheat right now is not GMO, but on the other hand, when farmers are growing wheat, they are often spraying it with the same herbicide known as glyphosate, also known as Roundup, on the wheat right before they harvest it because it dries it out and makes the harvesting more efficient. So one of the last things that happens to wheat is it's being sprayed with this herbicide, which is one of the most popular herbicides in the world. Many people probably buy it in the hardware store. This is not a benign chemical. This has recently been declared a probable human carcinogen by the World Health Organization. And we're spraying it on wheat, which is going straight into our flour and into our breads and things. And so there are people out there doing research on whether it is in fact the wheat that is causing the problem or whether it may be some of these chemicals that are sprayed on the wheat. Now, again, to go back to what we've talked about before, this just points up the fact that we don't really know how our food is made. We don't even know where it's made. Most people, if you ask them what they had for dinner, they would say that dinner comes from the supermarket, but they have no clue where it was before that, what state it was in, how it was grown, under what conditions. And this is really kind of pointing up the anxiety that most people have come to feel about even where their food comes from.
Will GMOs make their way, have they made their way into the fruits? I know, you know, we've seen the vegetables, but what about the fruits? What about apples? As they're talking about making GMO apples out of the yellow delicious, the golden delicious, so they don't look brown after a while.
Right, so that apple, the Arctic apple, was just released a couple of weeks ago, and there was a lot of hubbub for a little bit, and now I think that's kind of died away. I think it's really important to emphasize this, though, that the GMOs are not in the produce aisle of a supermarket. There are very few GMO vegetables or fruits. This is really about the big, high-calorie foods that we're eating. So if you eat a really unhealthy diet, you're getting an added insult because you're getting all these GMO grains. Now, there are different exceptions to this. There's something on the island of Hawaii called the GMO rainbow papaya, which was designed to withstand a virus. Now, this is a very interesting thing, and it's a very different kind of category because a virus was destroying the papaya crops on Hawaii, and they designed a GMO papaya that would withstand this virus, essentially inoculate the papaya so that these papaya growers can continue to make fruit. But that is such a tiny, tiny, vanishing fraction of what people eat. I mean, how many papayas have you eaten in the last week? Not many, but how much corn and soybeans have you eaten? Way more than you have any idea about, mainly because these crops are invisible in your diet. So that's really what we should be talking about, is how they influence what we actually eat.
How many states are fighting the good fight to try to do away with GMOs?
Well, the ones you hear about are the usual suspects, California, Vermont, those kinds of places. Hawaii has been doing a really hard job of trying to get some of these companies to at least tell them where they're growing these crops, what they're spraying on them, and the companies have been fighting tooth and nail trying to prevent any information from getting out about what they're doing on their crops. This drives these local activists crazy because you have chemical companies spraying on these farm fields that are right next to schools and towns and villages, and the people in these towns say, please just tell us what you're spraying, and the companies refuse to do it.
God.
So then the people will pass a law that requires the companies to tell them what's going on. The companies fight it and say, you don't even have the legal jurisdiction to do that. And they take it up to federal court. And, of course, as I mentioned before, the federal court system, the federal government, is way more tied and interested in protecting these companies than they are in protecting public health.
Do you think the CEOs of these big companies that produce these GMOs eat them?
Oh, I'm sure they would say they do. Although, you know, I remember hearing stories about, you know, some of these big, the CEOs of chemical companies eat organic food, which always struck me as ironic because they're peddling these chemicals that are sprayed on everything. I mean, what you will hear is that these GMOs are part of companies providing what they will say is inexpensive food for a lot of people. And that's exactly true. It is very inexpensive food.
Right.
It is not healthy food. As we all know, fast food, processed food, junk food, sodas, those are not healthy foods. And that is what these GMOs are being used to make.
I suspect, McKay, most people, because of price, will take the non-organic food just because of price.
Well, this is true, and this, I mean, not to open up a big can of worms, but this is
the
problem. You know, if you have federal subsidies going to pay for the foods that are the least healthy and the most chemically saturated, that's why the prices are going to stay down. If you had a shift and you said, you know, as a matter of public health, what we want to do is grow the least chemically saturated and the most nutritious food, then everybody, you know, the prices would come down and we would have an entirely different thing here. I mean, the problem is, as I point out in this book, that these chemical companies, the seed companies were chemical companies first. They were making chemical products for the war during World War II. Then they learned how to make pesticides that they sold to consumers and farmers, and now they're making our seeds. So the reason that we're eating all this stuff is because the industry that makes them is the chemical industry. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that you probably don't want your food being created by chemical companies. And this is just the way the last 50 or 60 years has unfolded has produced a national food system that is built on the ideas of chemical companies. There's just no getting around that. And now they control hundreds of millions of acres, which is to say a vast majority of our calories right now.
When you were last on with me, which was about a year ago, it was contamination we talked about. And that created the one heck of a storm. I got many emails positive about you when we talked about that.
Well, I'm glad, and I really think that this book is very similar to that one because it is talking about the things that we use every day. Contamination was about consumer products. Food Fight is about food. But both of them are basically saying that people don't know what they're getting when they go to the supermarket, when they go to the big box store, they buy stuff. They don't even bother looking at the labels because the labels have so little information on them anyway that even if they read them, they can't understand the words. The words are all like 25 syllables and they're all in Latin. They don't know what it means, whether you're buying cosmetics or whether you're buying a food product. And that is absurd. I mean, it is absurd that we've gotten to the point where intelligent people can't even make good decisions about what they eat or what they put on their bodies. And to my mind, it's because companies want it that way, because they figured if you knew, you wouldn't buy their stuff. And this brings up the whole government thing, which ought to be forcing companies to be way more transparent, because consumers deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and what they're putting on their bodies. That's the state we've gotten ourselves into.
Are you happy that we could win this war against these GMOs? Because generally, your book takes not a pro-GMO approach, but you're kind of neutral somewhat. You balance it.
Yeah, I mean, I it's very important that your listeners understand that I spent a lot of time talking to scientists that are pro-GMO, and I actually believe what they say when they say things like, we're going to part of what we're going to do, not the companies now, I'm talking about like university researchers, we would like to create a crop that is more nutritious or more able to survive in a world of climate change, that kind of thing. That is very different from this massive industrial scale thing. So, you know, my feeling as an educator and as a journalist is that when people have more information, they tend to make better decisions. And my main goal in writing these books is simply to give people information so they can make their own choices. People are not stupid. People get very angry when information is withheld from them, whether it's withheld by companies or withheld by the government. And it's our job as journalists to basically gather what information we can find and lay it out for people so they can make their own decisions, and then they will inevitably make better decisions. That's my hope.
Now, with GMOs, how many different GMO crops are out there now, the specific species?
Well, like I said, it's I think really useful to think of this in two categories. You have one category, which is dominated massively by corn and soy, which are produced to make all the junk food, processed food, all that stuff. Then there's a separate category of food crops that are being designed to actually help people in different kinds of troubled situations. So, for example, there are people working on something known as golden rice, which is a rice grain that has beta carotene in it, so it actually looks orange like a carrot, and it has the minerals and the vitamins in it that allow your body to create vitamin A. And they're not going to sell that to Americans because we don't have vitamin A deficiency here, but in places like Asia where they eat a lot of rice but they don't have a lot of nutrition, especially in the poor parts of Asia, the idea is if you could create a rice grain that had beta carotene in it, you could save millions of children from going blind. Now that is a totally different project. That is something that is in the service of health, in the service of, you know, saving children, mm-hmm. not in the service of pushing junk food on Americans. So those are two very different kinds of ways of thinking about GMOs.
What's going on, McKay, in Kansas? They're doing something novel.
Oh, yeah, gosh. So I have a whole chapter about this very, very cool project in Kansas at a place called the Land Institute, which is quite a famous agricultural research station. And they are trying to figure out a way to basically replace these hundreds of millions of acres of wheat, corn, and soybean. I don't know if you want to get into this, but there are incredible environmental problems connected to these other grains, the soy, wheat, and corn. And that's because they're annual crops that are planted every single year on hundreds of millions of acres and sprayed with all these chemicals. In Kansas, they're trying to create a food cropping system that would plant multiple different kinds of plants on one farm and allow them or design them so they would become perennial crops. So you wouldn't have to harvest them and replant them year after year after year, which destroys the soil. It uses up all our fresh water. One day you're going to be doing programs on how desperate we're going to be soon about the disappearing drinking water because it's all going onto these big industrial crops. So in Kansas, they're trying to create crops that would be way less dependent on pesticides, way less dependent on fresh water, and way more nutritious foods than these giant monoculture crops. So this could be a revolutionary system of replacing the American agricultural system with something that was way more sustainable, way more friendly for the water and the soil, and of course for climate, because climate change, as you know, is in large part caused by the petrochemical agricultural industries out there, and this would be much less dependent on fossil fuels as well.
This is pretty dramatic stuff, because this has been going on how many years now? When did these GMOs start hitting the market?
Well, here's a fascinating question. I think your listeners will like this. If you think about all of human existence, so ever since there were people, if you think of that entire time as a 24-hour clock, how many hours of that clock have human beings been farmers? How long have we been growing food as opposed to chasing it around or gathering it? The answer: on a 24-hour clock of human existence, we've been farming for 6 minutes. Okay, 6 minutes. Now, 6 minutes is the equivalent of 10,000 years. We've been farming for 10,000 years as a species, 10,000 years. How many years have we been genetically altering foods? About 25 years. So 25 years on the human clock is a blink, not even a blink. So this is so brand new. And when people say, oh, well, the research out there has been, you know, it's been around for a long time. A long time, what does that even mean? I mean, a big percentage of 25 years, that's nothing. As opposed to evolution, we've all evolved to eat certain kinds of foods over millions of years. So this stuff is brand new on the scene, and I think that's why people are so suspicious of it. They're intrigued by the technology. But when you're talking about putting food in your body, it's natural that you would be suspicious of something that has basically just popped up in the very last couple of years.
What's happening with the GMO foods that we give to animals? So we get it indirectly that way, too.
Oh, yeah. This is a really important point. Again, people may think that they're not eating GMOs because they buy a lot of vegetables, but the GMOs that you're getting in your diet are often coming to you because they are fed to the cows, pigs, and chickens that we eat. I don't know if you've heard this number, but Americans eat something like 9 billion, that's with a B, 9 billion animals a year.
Jeez.
And a vast majority of those animals are being, I mean, I'm talking about on the industrial scale, right? These are these farms that grow, or I should say like the slaughterhouses that are killing, 2,000 animals an hour, if you're talking about cows and pigs. There are farms on the eastern shore of Maryland. We have something like 570 million chickens just on the eastern shore of Maryland. I mean, these animals are all being fed GMO grains. That's where you're getting it. Because if you eat that meat, if you eat a chicken nugget or if you eat a cheap hamburger, those animals were fed GMO. So that's how you're getting it. You're not getting it in your carrots. You're getting it in your meat.
There is a controversy, of course, McKay, with this, because with GMOs comes some jobs, lots of jobs, farmers, scientists, people who have stakes in GMO production. What happens to them if we fight this?
I think this is a very important question, and it's worth remembering that we always have eaten, and we're just eating differently now than we used to. And in the last 50 years, the United States has lost 4 million small family farms.
Wow.
4 million farms. Now, what has happened, of course, is all those farms moved to the Midwest, and they got consolidated, and they got very, very large. So when you talk about losing jobs over the GMO thing, in a way, it's the opposite, because there used to be, during the Civil War, there was something like 50%, 52% of all Americans worked on a farm. Now we have 300 million people in this country, and only 2% work on farms. So in other words, farming has become a very different thing than it used to be. It used to be that there were lots of farms, and everybody knew a farmer, and you ate their food. Now nobody knows a farmer unless you live in the Midwest, or if you happen to live near a little boutique organic farm. But basically, farmers have become invisible. And my book is really wants to reemphasize this idea that farmers should become the most important people in a community. We should be supporting local farmers, giving them our money, asking them to grow us the best food that they can, and they'll do it because farmers are brilliant people that will grow whatever we ask them to grow. If we ask them to grow cheap, low nutrition food, they'll do it. If we ask them to grow really good, nutritious food, they'll do that too. They just want to supply what the market demands. Right now, the market is demanding very poor quality food, and that wasn't always the case, and doesn't have to be the case. So this book, the way this book kind of ends up is with this plea for people to reinvest themselves into local farms so that we can bring farming back into our actual communities.
Do you find that GMO foods, because they're cheaper, are being dumped more into more poverty-stricken areas in this country?
Well, I don't know if it's intentional, but that's if you think about, I live in Baltimore, right? So in Baltimore, like all cities, there are what are known as food deserts where you can't find a supermarket. You can only find junky, corner markets that have potato chips and, 10-year-old Twinkies or something on the shelves. And there's not a vegetable anywhere in sight. There's no fresh food anywhere in sight. So it's not like they're intentionally dumping them, but that's the stuff that
happens. Really, because it's cheaper. McKay, we'll come back and take some phone calls with you next.